Yes, you were explaining about the diseases and telling me about meningitis.
Yes, meningitis was one of the diseases, which was very distressing to see because it attacked usually young children. But there was a miracle drug which was brought from England, and this was MNB-693. And this, of course, at the commencement of the war, was the only drug which was thought to have a major impact on the casualties of the war, either civilian. This is long before the days of penicillin. But this MNB was like gold. It was also a miraculous cure for venereal diseases. And so the limited supply we had to make sure were not used for anything other than diseases which could only be treated. And so our chief medical officer, I remember, he used to keep these under lock and key, and we used only for cases like acute meningitis, where the child got no other chance of living. And they were quite miraculous. And of course you can imagine the joy of parents when they saw their child. So news got around, and the parents would carry their children on their back for days to get to a doctor because they'd heard of this wonderful, wonderful drug. Another disease which was endemic there, less spectacular but in total added to misery there many times over, was trachoma, the eye disease. And again, several members of the unit specialised in this and did miraculous work with the trachoma. They obviously didn't do anything like lens transplants, which are done, I think, now, but by the cauterisation and a lot of the minor surgical work, plus the medicines that they were able to do, had miraculous results with trachoma. They did, of course, a wonderful educative program in the local schools, explaining to the teachers and the parents that this trachoma wasn't against sent from heaven. It was brought about by the flies, and therefore they'd keep the flies away, and keep the flies away from the children's eyes, the chances are they wouldn't get trachoma. Other diseases you ask me about. In the South Ethiopia, sleeping sickness was a common disease, again brought about by the fly, tsetse fly, I think it is, and this of course had tremendous impact. It's funny, as I'm talking, most of these diseases were brought about by lack of knowledge and bad sanitation, weren't they? Certainly elephantiasis, sleeping sickness, meningitis, and this of course quite apart from the malarias, the black water fevers, the relapsing fevers, of which I got one.
Yes, I was going to ask you about your own health. You know, did you pick up any of these things?
Yes, I think several of the unit got malarias and relapsing fever, which is a common disease out there, I succumbed to. The health in Addis Ababa, people in Addis Ababa, really was very good because it was supervised by doctors who were there. Our accommodation was good, and so far we took over a couple of these ex-Italian villas, converted into dining rooms, lounge, a dozen bedrooms, which we shared to a bedroom. And that, in a way, was quite luxurious compared with all the stations and clinics and hospitals outside Addis Ababa, because many of them in the south were very primitive. And the my colleagues, several of them, we were worried in their effort to do their work, sometimes neglected their own health, understandably. And I do know one man who was down in the south who was at that stage a medical orderly who later qualified as a doctor after the war. He was very young, he couldn't have been more than 19 or 20 when he was out there. And he qualified as a really brilliant doctor after the war. We were particularly concerned about his health. We thought he was neglecting himself. And in fact, in the end, had to send somebody else down to make sure he did look after himself. That poor chap is now dead. He died. He went back to Africa. Don't think he went back to Ethiopia, or he may have done. But he obviously was a very dedicated person, and I suspect neglected his health again. And after qualifying, went back as a missionary, but has now died in his, I suppose, his 40s. It is interesting that of the, and I think in total we must have had 7 or 8 doctors, all of whom at that stage were young men, I think there can only be about 3 alive. So much more than half have died, which, in fact, about a third of the entire group has died, which, again, we were only commenting at following your talk, is a higher percentage, I think, than any other unit. Now, whether that's of any significance about the diseases or conditions in which they lived, I don't know, but it is significant. So,
I was going to ask you now about your clinic, the one
yes.
you said was outside
at the Tekla Heimerlok, yes. This was a satellite clinic of the Emmanuel Hospital, was its base. A satellite clinic of this Emmanuel Hospital. And I had their outpatients. It was really the main outpatients for the hospital, and anything that was felt to be needed hospitalisation, I used to refer to the clinic, which was 4 or 5 miles away. That's worked very well, except the Emmanuel Hospital itself soon became very full. I had to have about 20 beds at the clinic itself. And during these epidemics, I remember at one stage we'd got 5 or 6 people with typhus there, and it was there that we did this incineration of all clothes and shaving of heads and disinfectants. So the usual, I was there as the medical orderly in charge. There were half a dozen dressers, as they were called. These were the Ethiopian medical orderlies who'd had some training, usually under the Italians, and these were 3 men and 3 women, and so obviously the women looked after the women privacy. And I had a reasonable supply of drugs, but nothing like the ones that one would have wished for example, going back to this miracle drug MNV-693. This was only dispensed by the hospital because it was their final medical judgment as to who was to have it or not. But the run of diseases, everything from skin diseases, suspicion of childbirth irregularities, which one learned to diagnose and then sent on to hospital, to the mending of simple fractures, of putting into plaster, to the treatment of these horrendous tropical ulcers, which were one of the main diseases there. The diagnosis, where I suppose I became a bit of an expert, the diagnosis of leprosy. In fact, trying to deal the best one could with those cases one could deal with, and routing them onto the hospital for those that couldn't. I did this clinic in the mornings, and the clinic usually worked from, I suppose, about 8 o'clock till midday. And then in the afternoons, went to the leprosy camp, which is some 15 miles outside. And that was basically my job, plus the factor of in charge of all the medical supplies which came from Britain, and the keeping the clinics, outlying clinics, supplied with them. So this was a question of what were they short of, which was most things, what were the urgent things, and how to get transport to get them to them. And the only means of transport very often was these old Italian lorries, which were still run by Italian drivers under the control of the military, I suppose, and used by the military for getting their supplies. And we used to send our medical supplies in crates on these lorries. Sometimes they didn't get through, and sometimes they were lost or flooded out. But getting these supplies to the clinics was the other part of my work. Yes, I think that would be about the main.
Yes, how would you have communicated with the outposts?
We could only do this either through the good offices of the military. The military were based in Addis Ababa, which is the British military. And they had, as I mentioned earlier, outposts in some of the bigger cities where towns, when they're the towns. And they'd have a base which comprised usually of only half a dozen British NCOs training a few hundred Ethiopian army people. And they'd have either a military convoy or at least a military lorry taking up their supplies for everything from mail that had come from England for the NCOs to supplies of whatever. And we used to, through their good offices, both would send our mail and supplies when they'd got space on their trucks. If not, we had to ferry it around and find a local contractor. For those in the more remote areas, and particularly in the south, where there was virtually no British presence, it was a question of very often sending supplies which took weeks to get there. On one occasion, I remember, by mule and this sort of thing. So it was getting the supplies to them as best one could and as frequently. We had a newsletter which my predecessor as deputy commandant, a dear friend Jack Fraser, started off. And he used to write a newsletter, which was then cyclist-style, giving each one news of the other. You know, so-and-so had happened to Jack, and something had happened to Bill, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. And this was very often the only news they had of what was going on with their colleagues. And, of course, they're all desperate to get their mail, these airmail letters that came out to Addis Ababa. And then, of course, collecting their mail. So we get their mail coming in. Very often, as I say, the only route was either by people walking, their servants walking for days, or on mules.
Could you telephone? Or was there a sort of postal service for letters and, you know, your news sheet, for instance?
I think there was a postal service up to Asmara. That's from Addis Ababa right up to the major city in Eritrea. Adowa. But virtually, it wasn't a postal service. And there was no telephone service, as I recall, outside Addis Ababa itself. And we never even considered the telephone as a means of... And it just wasn't there. Now, the military have their own telephones, don't they? Field-to-field and methods of communicating. But we didn't use that, and our only communication was via private distribution and mail. Once the letters came in to Addis Ababa, we had to distribute them, and all the mail had to come in and sent out back to the UK.
Could I ask you now some more information about your leprosy camp?
Yes.
This would have been actually there before you went to it.
Run by Italians.
What sort of conditions did they live under, the lepers?
I think the camp originally, before the Italians arrived, had been set off by a missionary. I believe it was an American missionary founded, but I may be wrong there. The Italians took it over, and of course the Italians virtually expelled all the missionaries. I think largely because the missionaries were nonconformists, and of course the Italians were all strong Roman Catholics. Anyway, the missionaries were sent away. But the Italians took over the leprosy camp, I think, with a degree of self-interest, since they didn't permit lepers to be in the city of Addis Ababa. They were collected and put out into this camp. And the camp was built around a medical block, and then hundreds, literally hundreds, of these round little huts with thatch as tucles. Patients lived in these and came for their treatment to the hospital. There was a big communal kitchen for those who were at such an advanced state that they couldn't feed themselves. And so there were orderlies who prepared their basic food. And these were the supplies that the government had failed to send, and which nearly created the march on Addis. The medical supplies were fairly primitive and had been left mainly by the Italians when they were forced out. And the medical treatment at that stage was the famous Kolmogra oil, which until modern methods was the only treatment throughout the world for leprosy. And so the patients used to get injections, I think it was twice a week. And these were given by either me or the Ethiopian orderlies, of which there are about five, I think there were. Providing you gave them this injection once or twice a week and you fed them, there wasn't much more you could do. And this was only a slowing down of the disease. They were encouraged to be, they were large, it was a big isolated area and a mountain almost as big as that one over there, where they had their little plots of land, and they were encouraged to, they were given seed to grow their own things as they could. We encouraged better sanitation. We encouraged them to grow as much as they could, and we tried to evolve some sort of camp, democratic, self, you know, they had elected representatives and all this sort of thing. Because there must have been 300 or 400 there with wives and when I remember when I arrived, there must have been 80 children. And it was quickly seen that some of these were already got leprosy, and there's not much you could do with them. But it was also clear that they were having children in the camp, and there were some very young children who were not showing signs of leprosy, and certainly the newborn ones, no reason why they should. But segregation was important, and therefore we decided there was a separate building, not more than 300 or 400 yards away from the hospital, which we segregated and persuaded the parents to release their children if they were not affected. If they were not affected with leprosy, we persuaded them that they would, if they were taken away, they'd grow up into normal people. But if they stayed with their parents, they were 90% sure of getting leprosy. And they saw the logic of that. And we put them in this house. I suppose there would be 40 or 50 at the end there. And that, I think, was probably one of the constructive things that happened at the leprosy camp. Our first idea was that we would command a house near Addis Abeba itself. But when the parents heard of this, they refused to let their children go, fearing that this was another way of infanticide that we were going to do the children in. And they only would release their children on condition that through this big barbed wire fence we had, they could come up and see their children, although they couldn't touch them. And as long as they could see them, then they were quite happy to release them. In fact, quite pleased, I think, to acknowledge that they weren't going to get leprosy. But
that must have been quite a tricky situation, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was a very tricky situation when we had two of these children die. And for a time, the parents were demanding all their children back. And we tried to explain that nothing... It was sad that these children had died, and they died. I'm not sure one didn't die of meningitis, for example. But it wasn't the leprosy that killed them. Now, what happened, I think, when we left, I was very pleased that one of the nursing staff from a British medical missionary organisation took over the leprosy camp, and I've often wondered since how it prospered, but I don't know. I have never been back myself, and I don't know how it did get on.
Was there any risk of you picking this up? You know, does one catch
leprosy? I think one was a bit worried. One wore rubber gloves if one was dealing with open wounds. But I think if you'd been certainly living in the house, you'd have had a danger. But when it was explained to us that, in fact, it was less contagious than tuberculosis, and that providing you took the normal precautions, then there's no danger. Obviously, it went through one's mind because there was an emotive thing about leprosy, but in practice, I think there was little danger.
Were they treated very much as outcasts?
Oh, yes, totally. Totally. Because it was there was still a sort of hangover, I think, from the old biblical times, you know, leper unclean. In fact, I think this is why when it was diagnosed, the Italians, for public health reasons, whipped them out, and probably not too kindly, you know. The terrible, a woman or a man suspected he'd got leprosy, he hid it. The last thing he'd come, in fact, on several occasions when I diagnosed the beginnings of leprosy and told the patient what it was, but that we could do a lot to cure it, they became aggressive and totally disbelieving and dashed off because they knew that they could never go back and tell their parents or their village. They'd be outcasts immediately, and so they hid it. I suspect it's probably got the same stigma as AIDS has now, you know. So it's an educative process, but better nutrition, I suspect, and now the modern treatments. Although I was surprised to see that leprosy, I gather numerically, is still the largest disease in what was the British Empire, scattered all over the world. So it's still a factor. But I'm sure with modern drugs they could do a lot.
I believe you took the role as deputy commander.
Commandant, we used to call it. Yes.
Yes. This doesn't sound very pacific, does
no.
it? No. Also, before we go on to that, I was wondering, you know, did people know you were pacifists in the situation? You know, was it relevant to bring the issue up ever?
I think it was relevant with the government, where Haile Selassie and the government were very keen to demonstrate their independence from the British military conquerors, you see. They were very grateful to the British, but they equally wanted to demonstrate that they were independent. And to that extent, I think this was influential in selecting a sort of separate independent member of the Society of Friends, who, in their mind, was the dead opposite of military, right, as pacifists. I think outside that, the local population, in my judgment, had no idea. We were dressed in khaki. They thought we were all Hakims, which is the Amharic for doctor, and we were white, kind Amharic Hakims. They'd be, I think, some of them associated us with their memory of the previous medical missionaries who were before the Italians. So I think they were not, we were not recognised by the population generally, anything other than kindly doctors who were giving them treatment.
How about the Italians? Do you think it made a difference to your relationships with Italians rather than, say, military people?
Yes, there were very few of them, of course. For example, there were one or two at that Emmanuel Hospital. And I think they were allowed only to operate where they were under very strict military control. So there were none in the provinces where the military might think they were up to no good. The Italians that we did come across in Addis Ababa, I think they recognised that we were not military, and I think thought we were probably missionaries again, and took us as they found us, and found that by and large we were not aggressive anti-Italian or anything else.
And do you think it made a difference the way you treated them? You know, the fact that you looked at the Italians rather differently than, say, the British military would have done?
I don't think so. I think there were so few of them. And our contacts went great. And I don't think there was any great bitterness in the Ethiopian campaign. It was over, I say, miraculously short-lived. I don't think there was any great violence or butchery. And I think the Italian locals had no fear of the British military. They would never think that they'd be treated other than very kindly as prisoner of war or as civilian refugees.
I was going to ask you about your role as deputy commandant.
Oh, yes. Well, there was a commandant, and of course, I think in many areas of the unit's work, although you were not of the military and you were civilians, you could only operate within as much of the discipline area as the military would permit. For example, if there's a battle or war going on in the Middle East and we got blood transfusions there in the desert, you weren't allowed just to go around as civilian medical missionaries. And the universal recognition of this was the Red Cross, International Red Cross. So we were all members of the Red Cross and had to have a Red Cross emblem on our uniforms. And I think the word commandant is a Red Cross managerial control. And so I think most areas had to have, however they termed him, a leader who was responsible for those people under his charge. And if there was anything untoward that happened which the military took a view on, they would immediately call up our commandant and say, your man